Shalom, welcome to SJTF. This is Chaim Ben Pesach. This program is dedicated to elevating the souls of Simcha Bat Shlomo, Pesach Ben Dov, Meir Ben Yecheskel, and Yosef Ben Meir. Before we get to our many questions from our great JTFers, and before we discuss the upcoming presidential election, which of course we're going to discuss, the election's only a little bit over a week from now, and it's obviously a very crucial historic election, I want to start off by saying that obviously, our prayers are with all of the good people that are in the pathway of Hurricane Sandy, which appears to be a very powerful hurricane that is headed now toward the eastern coast of the United States. 60 million people are in the area which could be affected by the hurricane. And so we pray for all good people that are in the pathway of the hurricane, and for all of our great JTFers that may be in the pathway of the hurricane, because many of our great JTFers live in this area. It includes all of New York and includes other parts of the northeastern United States where many of our great JTFers reside. So for the sake of our great JTFers and for the sake of all good people, we pray that all the good people that are in these areas should be kept safe and should be unharmed and should not experience any destruction or any hardship as a result of this hurricane. Our prayers are with all of the people that are now in the pathway of what appears to be an extremely serious storm coming their way. God willing, nothing bad should happen to any good people. And secondly, before we get to the presidential election, there was another development in the past 24 hours in Israel. Our Hebrew movement, Hayamin Hamiti, is very much in the news in Israel again. This time because there is something called the Rabin Festival. Every time this year, this time of the year, the Israeli news media and the Israeli establishment and the Israeli educational institutions go crazy in commemorating and idolizing and worshiping the late Bolshevik dictator Yitzhak Rabin, Yemach Shmo V'Zichro Shem Reshaim Yirkav. Rabin was a mass murderer. Rabin was the person who murdered 16 Holocaust survivors who were right-wing Jews from the Irgun Tzvai Leumi on the Altalena in 1948. He sunk the ship and murdered in cold blood 16 Jews because they were not Marxists and socialists and self-hating traitors. And Rabin was the monster who invited the Arab Hitler Yasser Arafat and 80,000 Muslim Nazi armed terrorists from Fatah Ashaf into the land of Israel in the Oslo agreements. So he was a monstrously evil individual. And precisely because of his evil policies, the traitors who run Israel worship him and idolize him and have turned him into a god. And these individuals impose upon the people of Israel every year this massive festival where they commemorate him and eulogize him and worship him. And it's just absolutely grotesque. And most Israelis can't stand it. Most Israelis are sickened by it already, especially most young Israelis. So on our Hebrew Facebook page, one person came on our Hebrew Facebook page and posted a picture of Rabin that was very uncomplimentary to Rabin. Let's put it that way. And we didn't post it. Our movement in Israel didn't do that, and our movement in America didn't do that. It was somebody who came on the site and posted, someone who decided from Facebook to post this on our site. Right away, this drew hysterical reaction from numerous left-wing Facebook Hebrew pages, and from Walla, which is one of the biggest Hebrew websites in the world. It's an extreme left-wing media news media website in Israel, condemning us, calling us all types of names. So let me just clarify. Number one, we didn't post the picture. And there are sometimes people put things on our site, as all of our great JTFers know from the English forum. Sometimes people put things up that we agree with, sometimes things that we disagree with. But we have nothing to apologize for. Nothing. We don't apologize. We have nothing to apologize for. And too bad if there are people who are offended by free speech. This isn't even us posting this. But there is something called free speech. And Facebook is a site in the United States where there still is some free speech or a semblance of free speech. Also, Rabin, the mass murderer, the traitor, the evil monster who did such terrible, cruel things to the Jewish people, deserves no sympathy from any Jew. None whatsoever. And we will continue to expose him, and we're not going to be silenced, and nobody's going to shut us up in telling the people of Israel the truth about Yitzhak Rabin. Yimach shmo v'zichro shem reshaim yirkav. But this actually worked in our favor, because in the past 24 hours they gave us a new round of publicity for our forum, for our movement. It only helps us, obviously. Brings more attention. And most of the people responding, by the way, a substantial majority of the people who responded on our Facebook page in Hebrew, and a substantial people who have responded elsewhere, have responded positively to us. They're actually responding positively to us. So, I don't know. I just thought I'd share some of that good news with you. I think it's encouraging news. I thought it was good news. And finally, of course, before we get to our questions, I want to speak about this very important presidential race that we spent the past 6 years warning about. I mean, we spent the past 6 years warning about Barack Hussein Obama and the threat that he poses. Way before the 2008 election, we were warning about Obama. Unfortunately, in 2008, our warnings fell on deaf ears. Those people, I don't know if those people who heard the warnings were moved by them, I don't know, but Obama won the election by a big margin in 2008, by millions of votes. He won by a 7% margin in the popular vote, a big victory in the Electoral College. But for the past 6 years, we've been warning about this evil Muslim, anti-white, anti-American, anti-Semite, who has polluted the office of the White House for the past 4 years. We've been warning about him. And we've been warning ever since he was elected that if he, God forbid, gets a second term and doesn't have to face the voters again, we're in a lot of trouble. Israel is in a lot of trouble because he's going to brutally, relentlessly pressure Israel to commit national suicide, God forbid. The danger of an Iranian nuclear holocaust is a real danger. If this individual who has done everything he can to help Iran and to dilute sanctions and to prevent serious action against Iran, if he gets a second term, we're in a lot of trouble in terms of the Iranian nuclear program. On every front, he's a disaster. As far as America and America's survival, obviously he's a catastrophe. He's pushing America to the brink of bankruptcy with his massive spending, adding $6 trillion to the debt in less than 4 years, adding 17 million people to the food stamp rolls in less than 4 years. I mean, this guy is absolutely socializing America, and Obamacare is socialized medicine. He's destroying America's healthcare system. He's taking over the American economy with socialist big government programs and bureaucracy. He's absolutely going to wreck the economy in a way where it's hard to see how the economy will ever recover. I mean, this could be a free fall eventually. If the United States can't pay its bills, the American economy can head into a free fall because nobody can bail out the United States government. If the United States government becomes like Greece or like Portugal or Ireland or countries in Europe that have been teetering on the brink of bankruptcy and that only got out because they were bailed out because they're small countries, but America, nobody can bail out. It's too big. This is where Obama is leading the United States, and he is a Muslim. His policies are so dangerous for the future of America, Israel, and the world. And so finally it all comes to a head in a little bit over a week. God willing that the American people decide to elect Mitt Romney and get rid of this vicious Muslim Jew hater. Where does the race stand? Well, it depends which polls you look at. It appears to be a close race in polls for the popular vote. Many claim that Obama has an advantage in the Electoral College. I don't know. Some polls indicate that he would have an advantage, that it's going to be hard for Mitt Romney to get to 270 electoral votes, which is what you need to win an electoral vote majority and get elected president. Is that true? You have all types of analysts and experts who tell you, you know, that the odds are against Romney winning a majority in the Electoral College. I hope that's not true. I hope that the undecided break for Romney. if the undecided voters break for Romney, and if he gains at the last minute, and if he has a stronger get-out-the-vote operation, he can win. It is possible that he can win. This is a tough election, a very tough fight. It appears to be a close election, no question about that. Obama does have some significant advantages. The media supports him. He has the powers of incumbency. He has the labor unions behind him. He has a lot of things going in his favor, but Mitt Romney also has things in his favor. Most Americans think the economy is very bad, and most Americans don't like the job Obama has done when it comes to the economy. So, I mean, there are many issues in Mitt Romney's favor. So this is, I think that this is an election which can go either way. I think it's a close election. And therefore, we have to do everything we can until the last minute in order to try to influence things, in order to try to elect Mitt Romney and prevent the catastrophe of a second Obama term. I just want to say, by the way, that to those of you in JTF, you know, you can join all types of forums, and I guess there are different types of forums out there, and I guess there are different types of organizations that exist out there. I don't know. But I think those of you that have been with us have a lot to be proud of. I mean, aren't you proud? Those of you that have been following what we've been doing in the campaign for president, let's just talk about the campaign for president. Aren't you proud of JTF? I am. I'm very proud of JTF. I think JTF has done something that we can all be proud of. I mean, the hundreds of videos that we put up, the relentless campaign that we put forward, the high-quality videos. And you've seen the videos, and you know that they're strong and convincing and high quality. It's a pity that more people don't see them. It's a pity that tens of millions of people don't see them. That is just hundreds of thousands of people have seen our videos. I mean, we've shown you some videos that have, I've shown you at least two videos that have over 80,000. One of them, by the way, now the best anti-Obama video anywhere on the internet has over 90,000 views. Another video that was put up by Dan Ben-Noach has over 80,000 views. That's already over 170,000 just between those two videos. I've shown you another one that has about 30,000 views. So, I mean, you add that, just that by in and of itself, you've got a couple of 100,000 views right there. And of course, we've had hundreds of videos up there. And some of the videos have thousands of views, and some of the videos have hundreds of views. But when you add it all up, it's quite a few people for considering our budget have seen our videos. And we've done the best we can. Don't you think we have something to be proud of as an organization and as a movement? Haven't we done a pretty good job for an organization with a limited budget? I think we've put up some pretty impressive things and put together a very impressive case in the presidential election. We've tried our best and we've taken a noble stand for a noble cause. And I think that's something we can be proud of. We've tried to influence the most important event that's taking place this year. The presidential election is the most important event taking place right now. And we've tried to influence that in the only way that anybody with any sanity would want to influence it, to defeat Obama and to elect Mitt Romney. I think you can be proud of what we've done in the campaign. If you look at our videos and you look at our campaign on YouTube and on Facebook, and you look at how hard we've all tried and how much we've wanted to influence this election, I think you can be proud that you were part of an organization and a movement that did present a very compelling case. The only downside is that more people haven't seen our videos and that we don't have a bigger budget so that we can't reach even more people. That's the only downside. Because for those people who do see our videos, there's only an upside. Our videos are very convincing and very high quality and something to truly be proud of. That doesn't mean everybody's going to agree with us. I mean, we're saying things that a lot of people don't like. The truth bothers a lot of people, but we present the truth in a compelling, convincing, powerful way. And that's something I think we can be proud of. And so we have to keep fighting to the last minute. And we have to remember that even after the election, the election's only a little bit over a week from now, 8 days from now, even after the election, JTF is needed now more than ever. No matter who wins the election, we're going to be needed now more than ever to save little Israel from the possibility of a nuclear Iran, from the danger of creating a so-called Palestine state, which comes back on the table, especially if Obama's reelected, God forbid. From the Israel, we're going to be deeply involved in the Israeli election that's going to be held this January, in January of 2013. In less than 3 months, we're going to have the Israeli elections. So JTF's very high quality Hebrew videos, which have reached a large percentage of Israeli Jews, very important, very, very important. And you've got a lot to be proud of when it comes to that too, that you've been helping us reach Jews in the Holy Land with the truth. I mean, that's the most blessed thing I think anybody could do. But we need it now more than ever to make a difference. And I think we've shown that, we put together something that you can be proud of. And God willing, we'll continue to do things that will make our members proud, both here and in Israel. And so we need your help. We need your help, first of all, helping us to spread the videos, the English and the Hebrew videos. Whenever we put an English or Hebrew video up, please like, favorite, comment. Please help us spread the word on those videos on YouTube and on Facebook. Help us with that. We need your help on the forum, making the forum an attractive place so more people want to sign on. Thousands of people visit our forum because of the videos. They come out of curiosity. They visit the forum. We want those people to want to join the forum and become active on the forum. We know that it's human nature not to want to actually join and get involved and actually write. Most people are apathetic. Most people are don't want to actually get directly involved. That's just human nature. We understand that, but we want to capture as big a percentage as we can. And thousands of people read what we have on the forum, so it's important. So we need your help with the videos. We need your help on the forum. We need your help with our Facebook accounts, the English and the Hebrew Facebook accounts. And we need, most of all, we need your financial support. Great JTFers with their credit cards help us on a regular basis. They go to hayamin.org. Hayamin.org is our Hebrew main page. And on hayamin.org, there's a donate button on top in English. Even though the page is in Hebrew, on top in English, you see, in clear English letters, the word donate. And people go, they click on the donate button, and with their credit card, in a few minutes, they're able to help JTF so that we could put forward the high-quality campaign that we do, both here and in Israel, to try to make this a better world, to try to tell the truth, to try to expose the facts that are so urgently necessary that people become aware of what the real truth is. And so we thank our great JTFers for helping us with their credit cards, and we thank equally as much the great JTFers who generously send us on a regular basis checks, money orders, cash donations to our post office box through the regular mail. God bless all the great JTFers who help us financially, and who make it possible for us to do whatever we are able to do. And who knows, if it's a close enough election, we could make a difference. I don't know if we will. But at least you see that we try our best, and I think we put together, considering our budget, I think we put together a pretty impressive effort here that we could be proud of. And finally, we need your prayers. Every JTFer should pray to God that Mitt Romney win the election on November 6th. We need your prayers. Prayers are very important. We have to pray for Mitt Romney's victory on November 6th. And we have to, and please also add a prayer that JTF succeed both in America and in Israel in its campaign to wake people up and tell people the truth. Add a prayer for us as well. Anyway, I want to thank our great members, and now with all the challenges we have ahead of us, let's get to our many great questions. And we start off with Kibbutz, who is a new member, who writes, and I quote, "One, should self-hating Jews be tried and executed for treason?" Unquote. Well, that's a question that has already been answered by American and Israeli law under United States federal law. Anyone convicted of treason is subject to the death penalty, can receive the death penalty or life in prison without parole. Those are the two possible punishments for someone convicted of treason in the United States, either the death penalty or life in prison without parole. That's United States law. And you're asking about self-hating Jews. If we're talking about Israel, under Israeli law, anyone convicted of treason can also face the death penalty, is subject to the death penalty. No one has been given the death penalty, but under Israeli law that has been on the books since the creation of the state, there is a death penalty under Israeli law, and anyone convicted of treason can face the death penalty. So it's part of existing law. And I think it's appropriately part of existing law, because I think if someone is a traitor and endangers the and commits an act of treason and endangers the survival and security of their people, I think their people have a right to defend themselves and protect themselves. And Kibbutz writes, too, what is anti-JTF on YouTube, unquote? Well, you know, anti-Chaim Ben Pesach is one of many sites that Peace Now, that Shalom Achshav, have created on YouTube to condemn us. Anyway, thank you for your questions. And now we go to the great Yimach Shmo to Obama, who writes, and I quote, what are your thoughts on Jack Tramiel, who passed away earlier this year? Was he a self-hating Jew? Unquote. Yimach Shmo to Obama, I have to apologize. I do not know anything about Jack Tramiel. I honestly don't know anything about him, and I don't want to comment on someone if I don't have enough information on him. I just don't know enough about him to be able to give a well-informed answer to your question. I apologize. Thank you so much, Yimach Shmo, for... Yimach Shmo is someone who contributes tremendously to the forum and has helped us on YouTube and helps us everywhere. Just a wonderful person. God bless Yimach Shmo to Obama. And now we go to the great Chicago Jew, who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, I plan on visiting New York next year and would be delighted to meet you. Can I please have your private email, or do you have mine? Unquote. Well, Chicago Jew, you can write to me on the forum. You can always write to me on the forum, and I would be, of course, I'd be happy to meet you when you come to New York. Maybe you want to come, in fact, to our monthly, I don't know when you're coming, but if you want, you could schedule your trip to come also, to come to our monthly JTF meeting when all JTFers get together. We'd be delighted to have you. And certainly it would be a pleasure to meet you when you come to New York. Thank you so much, Chicago Jew. And now the great Da Vinci writes, and I quote, Dear Chaim, German Nazis and other scum on the internet say that the bombing of Dresden was a needless human right violation. Please refute this, unquote. Okay, great point. The bombing of Dresden was a very necessary and appropriate attack on Nazi Germany, which was responsible for killing 50 million people and which was trying to conquer the whole world, which murdered over 6 million innocent Jewish men, women, and children, and promised to exterminate the whole Jewish people, and promised actually to exterminate other whole peoples, which was the Nazi ideology, the demonic Nazi ideology. The people of Germany and the people of Dresden overwhelmingly, almost unanimously, fanatically supported Hitler and the Nazis and fought for Hitler and the Nazis. So the bombing of Dresden in order to force Germany to surrender and in order to cripple Germany in the war and bring an end to the war, I think was at the very least that the Allies should have done. I actually think that the Allies were much too nice to Germany after the war. Germany got away with the most horrific crimes in human history. Never paid a real price. Never paid a price for all the terrible things they did. Anyway, thank you, Da Vinci. And now we go to the great Brennan fan, who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, why does God seldom, if ever, compel us to choose the soulmate that he designed for us? Unquote. Well, first of all, we have free will, Brennan fan. You know, God can create for us all types of wonderful possibilities in life, and we could decide not to do what we're supposed to do. There are all types of possible answers to this, and I guess it depends upon each particular situation. Some people may never meet their soulmate as a punishment. I mean, one of the possible punishments people get is that they don't meet their soulmate. They don't get to meet their soulmate, which I think should be an incentive for people to want to be righteous and want to do what God commands them to do, because then they get the reward of having these good things in life, like meeting their soulmate. But God does not force somebody to do right. God gives people the free choice. That's the way God created the world. That's what God's will is. God's will is that we choose out of our own free will to do right. And why is that? Because if God forces us and we do the right thing like robots, even if we get the reward after that, what are we getting rewarded for? Is it just? It's not just. We're getting rewarded and we didn't earn it. We were forced to do it. We didn't earn it on our own. If somebody gives you something for nothing, something for free, over and over again, and you get it, and you know you don't deserve it, you're not really going to enjoy it. You're not really going to enjoy it the same way that you would enjoy it if you knew that you earned something, that this was something you get. It's a wonderful thing, but you're getting this because you earned it. And that's the type of joy that God wants us to have for the reward that He wants to give us, the eternal reward that He wants to give us. So, you know, everything, whether it comes to, whether it involves our meeting our soulmate or getting married to our soulmate and living with our soulmate or any of the other things that God has designed for us, a lot of this involves free will, and a lot of this involves our making the right decisions in life. Anyway, thank you, Brennan Fan. And now we go to the great Selhar, who writes, and I quote, and Selhar, of course, is also, before I say what Selhar has written, before we quote Selhar over here, he's also very active on our Hebrew forum. Selhar writes, and I quote, "What happened to the ambassador in Libya? Did Obama know the facts immediately after or during the event, and is there now a presidential cover-up?" Unquote. Okay, great question, and absolutely, absolutely irrelevant, obviously irrelevant question that unfortunately the left-wing news media in this country is covering up. The ambassador in Libya and three other Americans were brutally murdered by Muslim terrorists, a Muslim terrorist mob that attacked the American consulate in Benghazi. This was a pre-planned terrorist attack by terrorist organizations. Now, here's what we know. We know that the ambassador and the other diplomats in Libya repeatedly requested added protection, and the Obama administration turned them down. We know that there were two prior attacks in Libya, including one where they blew a hole in the Libyan consulate big enough to fit a truck through. Two prior serious terrorist attacks on that consulate, so they knew that there was a very serious security problem there. And that was ignored by the Obama administration and the State Department when they rejected the request of the Libyan consulate for more protection. We also know that the British consulate, which was right next door to the American consulate, left Libya. They closed down and left because they said it's unsafe. They pulled all their diplomats out before this attack. We also know that the Red Cross, which was close to the consulate, pulled all of their personnel out because they said it was just too unsafe. It was just that the situation was so unsafe they couldn't keep any of the Red Cross couldn't keep any of their people there. So there was no question that this was an unbelievably dangerous situation. And there was an urgent need for more protection, or either for more protection or to pull the diplomats out. The Obama administration did not pull the diplomats out the way the British did, the way the Red Cross did. They did not offer more protection or grant the request for more protection, despite the fact that there were two terrorist attacks before this. So the Obama administration left these four Americans open to being murdered. Left them open and basically made them sitting ducks, waiting to be slaughtered. And then after these four Americans were murdered, Obama immediately, together with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Susan Rice, the UN ambassador, immediately began a campaign of cover-up, immediately began saying that this was because of a video. They immediately started condemning the video. They refused to call it a terrorist attack. And by the way, when Obama was out on the White House lawn the next day, he did not call this a terrorist attack, despite the lie that was told in the second debate with Mitt Romney. He did not call this a terrorist attack. Obama just said in general, acts of terror will not deter us. But he wasn't referring to what happened in Benghazi. When he was referring to what happened in Benghazi, he repeatedly blamed the video the Mohammed video or the Muslim video that the Muslims went so crazy over, a video on YouTube. He repeatedly blamed that as the cause of this. And repeatedly kept spreading the notion that this was like a spontaneous demonstration, and he refused to call it a terrorist attack. When David Letterman asked him if this is a terrorist attack, he refused to call it a terrorist attack. On The View, when he was asked if this is a terrorist attack, that hideous left-wing show called The View, he refused to call it a terrorist attack. He absolutely refused, for at least 2 weeks after the attack, he refused to call it a terrorist attack. And in the White House briefing room, his White House spokesman refused to call it a terrorist attack, and Hillary Clinton refused to call it a terrorist attack. So there was a concerted, organized cover-up. Why were they doing this? Why are they refusing to call it a terrorist attack? Because Obama never wants to use the word terrorism in regard to his fellow Muslims. Obama has ordered the administration never to use the term Muslim terrorists or Islamic terror. That's not permitted in the Obama administration. Those words were removed from all documents and all statements. You're not allowed to use that term. Obama referred to the Muslim terrorist who murdered American soldiers at Fort Hood. He said that this was workplace violence. He refused to call that a terrorist attack. He called it workplace violence. So the Obama administration is constantly trying to cover up for their fellow Muslims, and they want to create a narrative before the election. They wanted to create a narrative whereby all Muslim terrorism has been solved, and Obama has solved the problem, and we don't have Muslim terrorism anymore. Because the Benghazi incident, the Fort Hood terrorist attack, and all these other incidents contradict that narrative, Obama has done everything he can to cover up and lie and to scandalously endanger the lives of Americans, and then when they are murdered, to lie about the circumstances surrounding their murder. So this is a tremendous scandal, a worse scandal than Watergate, a worse scandal than scandals which brought presidents down that got them removed from office. Because in Watergate, bugs were put in an office and there was eavesdropping, but no one was killed. In this scandal, 4 people were killed. This is much worse than Watergate, and the media ignores this because their candidate, Barack Hussein Obama, was guilty. Anyway, thank you, Tzelhar. And now the great Maimonides writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, what do you think about the friendly letter that Egypt's President Morsi sent to Israel's President Peres, unquote. Oh, I'm not surprised. One anti-Semite writing to another. Morsi, the dictator of Egypt, comes from the Muslim Brotherhood, a Nazi terror organization with ties to Al-Qaeda, with ties to the Iranian terrorist regime, whose spiritual leader, and we've had videos where we've shown you this, the spiritual leader of the Muslim Brotherhood, who is Morsi's spiritual leader, has said that the Holocaust, has praised the Holocaust, and has said that he hopes that the Muslims will be able to carry out a Holocaust just like the Holocaust the German Nazis carried out against the Jews. And this was on Egyptian television. They put pictures of the Jews in the gas chambers and the ovens and the Jews and the pictures of dead Jewish bodies from the Holocaust and say and praise Allah, and they pray and they celebrate. They think this is wonderful when they show the pictures of Jews being murdered in the Holocaust. And then the Muslim Brotherhood then say, next time, Inshallah, with the help of Allah, next time, we're going to be the ones to carry out the Holocaust against the Jews. That's Egypt's President Morsi, that Barack Hussein Obama, by the way, wants to give billions of more dollars to. And so, of course, he's going to write to Shimon Peres, because he knows Shimon Peres supports all Nazis and all Jew haters, whether it was Yasser Arafat, doesn't matter who. Peres is always there to back every Nazi and every Jew hater. So, you know, this is one anti-Semite writing to another. Anyway, thank you very much, Maimonides. And now we go to the great British sword, who writes, and I quote, debates were good, but I smell devilry. Obama handed canting of the votes to Spanish company SCYTL. We may yet have to impeach him for electoral fraud, unquote. British sword, I hope the American people impeach him on November 6th, because the American people can throw him out of office in another week. And God willing, I hope they do, because Congress is not going to throw him out of office, unfortunately. I don't know anything about this particular issue that you're raising. It may be a serious issue. I don't know enough British sort to comment on it, but I can tell you, British sort, that there is a lot of election fraud that takes place. The Obama supporters vote more than once in some cases. In many cases. Some of them, we showed you a video where one of them was bragging about it on TV that he voted twice. And dead people vote. And children vote. And illegal aliens vote. I mean, there are all types of things that take place, especially with mail-in voting. You have a lot of mail-in voting, so it's easy to commit a lot of fraud when it comes to things, people just mailing in ballots. That's easy to commit fraud that way. The son of a congressman from Virginia, a Democrat congressman from Virginia, recently had to resign because he was caught on tape instructing people and planning how to commit voter fraud. There is massive voter fraud that takes place now, and the courts have been siding with those people who want to commit the voter fraud, Acorn and the others. The courts have been throwing out attempts to just get people to show their voter ID. And so, unfortunately, we're going to have a lot of fraud in this election. And if the election's close enough, that could actually swing the election, God forbid, to Obama. So it's a very serious issue. The issue of voter fraud is a very, very serious problem in the United States. Anyway, thank you very much, British Sword. And now we go to the great Tag Mechir Tzedek, who writes, and I quote, "Does halacha permit Bnei Noach to become citizens of Israel without conversion and coming from outside the land to the land?" Unquote. yes, but we have to be very careful here. I mean, Bnei Noach can come to the land of Israel. Let's speak about that first. The citizenship part, it depends what you define, how you define a citizen. But the part of coming from outside the land to live in Israel, are Bnei Noach allowed to do that? There are certain conditions, though. We have to be sure that they're really Bnei Noach, that they're really righteous Gentiles who want to follow the seven laws of Noah in the Torah. And why do I speak about sincerity being an important issue here? Because you have certain third world people from Africa and from other third world countries who will say anything and do anything to go from their God-forsaken countries to the modern and beautiful state of Israel, because they want to live in Israel. They don't want to live in Eritrea or Sudan or other places. So they're willing to say they're Bnei Noach. They're willing to say anything that they have to. They're willing to pretend they convert. I mean, just all a farce. So we've got to be careful about that. We can't just open up and say, okay, everybody from anywhere in the world, if you say you're Bnei Noach, come on in. We have to be concerned about sincerity and authenticity here. Also, there must always be, in a halachic Israel, there must always be an overwhelming Jewish majority because it's a Jewish state. The righteous Gentiles in the next world are going to control every nation and land outside of Israel. The Jews are going to control the land of Israel. But there will be a certain number of Gentiles living with the Jews in the land of Israel. They're not going to be the Arab Muslim Nazis, that's for sure. They're going to be righteous Gentiles, because in the next world, the only people that are going to be left are going to be righteous Gentiles, whether they're righteous Jews or righteous Gentiles. Righteous people are going to be the people that are going to be in the next world. The other people are not going to be. They're going to be destroyed. So, under halacha, yes. When I say they're going to be destroyed, in other words, I don't know exactly how that's going to happen. It may just be that they die off. Who knows what God... There's no question God is going to change the rules. And by the way, the world to come is this world. The world to come in Judaism, the world of paradise is going to be this world. This world will turn into a paradise in the next world when the final redemption comes. That's the Jewish view. But... can righteous Gentiles come to live in Israel? When I say righteous Gentiles, I mean Bnei Noach. Can they come? Are they permitted to come to live in Israel? If they're really sincere and if they're really abiding by the laws of being Bnei Noach, yes, under halacha, they can come to live in Israel. As far as citizenship is concerned, again, it depends what you define as citizenship. But certainly, Bnei Noach have a lot of rights in the land of Israel, and would be a very honored and respected part of the life of the people of Israel when we do finally have a Torah true state. So again, the conditions are that they have to be completely sincere, and that they has to, and only a limited number can come, because they have to be, we have to have an overwhelming Jewish majority at all times in Israel, because it is a Jewish state. But under those conditions, as long as it meets those two conditions, Bnei Noach are permitted to come and live in the land of Israel. Anyway, thank you very much, Tag Mechir. And now we go to the great LKZ, who writes, and I quote, "Reagan said, a president is only as good as the people that elect him. Is violence and destruction the only thing that will change America's evil ways?" Unquote. I hope not. I hope that America will wake up. I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen, and I don't know if America will change her evil ways. If America re-elects Obama and keeps supporting evil, America will face destruction. Anyone who goes against Israel and the Jews will get on their own head what they wanted to do to the Jews. That's the lesson of history, and that's what the Bible promises us. So, you know, it's up to the American people to change their ways. The American people, the fact that they voted for someone like Obama and have done certain other things that are very decadent and evil, those are very serious sins. So hopefully the American people will wake up and recognize that this type of behavior will only lead to destruction. And I hope that it doesn't take violence and destruction to wake Americans up. I hope not. By the way, Hurricane Sandy, which is on its way now to the eastern shore of the United States, which we spoke about in the beginning of this program, notice that it's coming toward that section of the United States which supports Obama more than any other place, the Northeast. Interesting, right before the election, the place where Obama has his strongest support. Just an interesting, I don't claim to be a prophet and I don't claim to be God's spokesman, but just an interesting observation. Anyway, thank you, LKZ. And now we go to the great Dr. Dan, who is, of course, not only our great global moderator, but is the voice of reason and common sense and logic. The great Dr. Dan writes, and I quote, "Who were Yonatan and Yechezkel in the Bible, and what were their virtues that made them so important to us?" Unquote. Oh, Dr. Dan, you're bringing up two very great people, among the greatest people that ever lived. One of them is Yonatan. Yonatan in Hebrew is Jonathan. And Yonatan was the son of the first king of Israel, King Saul, Shaul in Hebrew. And he was supposed to succeed his father when his father, you know, in Israel, under kings, when you have kings, of course, the prince succeeds the king. He was going to be next in line to be the king. But he willingly, when he saw the greatness of David, when he saw how great David was, David killed Goliath, and David fought battles and won miraculous victories, and David was such a great leader. And he saw that David had what it took to be a great king, a magnificent king. Even though Yonatan, was also had what it took to be a great king. But he saw that David was even greater than him. And so he stepped aside and loyally wanted to support David and risked his life and wanted to support David and make David the king and serve David as the king. Can you imagine someone nowadays who could become, this is like someone running for president, one of the candidates for president saying, "You know something, I'd be a good president, but I'm going to step aside because this other guy running against me, I think he'd be even better than me, and I just want the best for the country." I mean, can you imagine that happening nowadays? That's what happened with Yonatan. He put his ego aside, he put his ambitions aside, even though he himself was very talented and could easily have justified saying, "I want to be king, I'm very righteous, I believe in Hashem, I believe in the Torah, I'm a great scholar, I'm a prophet, I have all the qualifications to be a great leader. Why should I step aside? My father's the king, I'm next in line, that's the way it should be. Well, I'm going to step aside for this other guy." He could easily have said that, but no. He wanted only what was best for his people and for the world. And so even though he was qualified, he saw David was even more qualified and would be even greater than him, and so he loyally served David. That was Yonatan. What a great, magnificent Jew. And what a hero he was. I mean, he himself, by the way, led and won tremendous victories for the Jewish people, military victories. That was the great Yonatan. Yechezkel was one of the great prophets, one of the greatest prophets, and is, in fact, one of the most important books of the prophets in the Bible, is the prophet of Yechezkel. In English, it's Ezekiel. He was a descendant of Yehoshua, of Joshua. Joshua, who succeeded Moses and liberated the land of Israel. Yechezkel was actually one of his descendants. And he was exiled into Babylon. He prophesied in Babylon, which is rare. Usually prophecy is only in the land of Israel. You don't have prophecy outside the land of Israel usually. But because he started being a prophet in Israel, even when he was exiled, he was able to continue his prophecy even in Babylon. And many of his prophecies were very sad because he was prophesying about the terrible doom, the destruction of the temple, and many other terrible things that he foresaw that eventually did happen. Everything he said was going to happen did happen. And so a lot of his prophecies were very sad and very gloomy, and a lot of Jews in his day despised him because he told the truth. He told the truth that people didn't want to hear. But he also prophesied that in the end of days, wonderful things, magnificent things would happen, which are also coming true. His prophecies about the Jews returning to their land and everything, I mean, that's all coming true also. And he also, his famous chapter 37, in chapter 37 of the book of Ezekiel, Yechezkel, we have his famous dry bones prophecy, which is about Techiyat HaMetim, the resurrection of the dead, where you see the dry bones coming out of the grave and the dead being resurrected. That's part of his biblical prophecy. That's part of this in the Bible. It's called the dry bones story, where God asks, can these dry bones live again? And they do. And you see them all come to life. He sees this great prophetic vision of dead people coming to life again and this great miracle occurring, which is an intrinsic, integral part of biblical belief, that there will be resurrection of the dead. And I consider it to be one of the most inspiring and magnificent parts of the Bible. I love the book of Yechezkel, Sefer Yechezkel, the book of Ezekiel. And I love his prophecies, and of course the prophecy, the resurrection of the dead, what a beautiful, magnificent vision that death will not defeat us in the end. Jews refuse to accept death, refuse to accept that death is going to defeat us in the end. We will not be defeated by death. We believe that God will bring those Jews, the good Jews and the good Gentiles, the righteous people, back to life forever. What a beautiful belief. And that's in the book of Yechezkel, in the book of the Bible. Anyway, thank you so much, Dr. Dan. And now we go to the great EB22, who writes, and I quote, please discuss the potential impact that Gary Johnson and or other third party candidates could have on the 2012 presidential election, unquote. Well, obviously Gary Johnson can take enough votes away from Mitt Romney if it's a close enough election to tip the election to Barack Hussein Obama. We saw the opposite happen. We saw what Ralph Nader did in the year 2000. Ralph Nader took enough votes away from Al Gore to enable George W. Bush to get elected in 2000. If Ralph Nader had not been running, there's no doubt that Al Gore would have won in Florida, and if he would have carried Florida, he would have won the presidency. So minor third party candidates in a close enough election can tip the election one way or the other. And Gary Johnson now is taking votes away from Mitt Romney. So he could be responsible, God forbid, for the re-election of Barack Hussein Obama, God forbid. Anyway, thank you, EB22. And now we go to the great Ephraim, who writes, and I quote, when the lost tribes come back, will they be considered Jews, Israelites, or converts? Will they be expected to follow the same halakha as Judah, unquote? First of all, Ephraim, great question. And first of all the tribes have to follow the same halakha, which is Jewish law, the same Torah. The Torah is for all the tribes of Israel. They all must follow Torah law. There is no distinction made there. There are certain special extra requirements for the tribe, for the Levites, and for the Kohanim. The Kohanim are the priests. There are certain categories that were selected for certain special roles in the Holy Temple. They have extra laws that they have to follow, but the concept of following the Torah and doing what the Torah commands is a concept that all Jews, whether you call them Jews or Israelites or Hebrews, all have to follow. Why am I saying whether you call them Jews or Israelites or Hebrews? Because the word Jew comes from the tribe of Judah. It comes from Yehuda. Yehudi is how you say Jew in Hebrew, and Yehuda is the tribe. So the word Jew comes from the tribe Judah, because the vast majority of people who are Jews today come from the tribe Judah. The vast majority of Jews who survived the assimilation and all the other things that have happened throughout history. But whether, you know, when we have the 12 tribes again, which eventually we will they be called Jews or Israelites or Hebrews? It doesn't really matter, because they're going to be following the same religion, the religion of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the Torah. They all have to follow the Torah. The 12 tribes, the 10 lost tribes, there are 10 tribes that are not with us anymore, that have been lost. The 10 lost tribes in the next world could be just people who were dead, who are coming back, because when we have resurrection of the dead. In other words, people from the 10 lost tribes who were still Hebrews or Israelites or Jews, but who passed away, they, when they come back from the dead, they once again are going to come back from all of the tribes. Whether or not we have any people now who have long been lost and disconnected from the Jewish people, and are part of the, will maybe have some distant connection to the 10 lost tribes, whether they're going to come back, that, I don't know, that's very questionable. I don't know the answer to that. That I don't know the answer to. Anyway, I hope that that's somewhat helpful, Ephraim, and I thank you. And now we go to the great Muman 613, who always has very, very high quality posts on the forum. Great posts on Judaism and the Torah with sources. Muman writes, and I quote, "Shalom Chaim, please tell us your favorite drash on Abraham our father," unquote. Okay, great. Giving me a great opportunity here, Muman. Abraham Avinu, Abraham our father. Abraham's father was Terach. And Abraham's father Terach was probably one of the biggest dealers in the world of stone idols and graven images. He preached idolatry. Almost everybody believed in idolatry at that time. And Terach was very wealthy and very charismatic, and he had a huge shop where they sold the most fancy graven images and the biggest stone idols and biggest graven images. And people came from all over the world to buy the stone idols and the graven images from the shop of Terach. And again, this is Abraham's father, Terach, an idolater. Anyway, one day, Terach, and this is from the, by the way, what I'm speaking to you about now is called Torah Shebe'al Peh. Yesh Torah Shebe'al Peh. And Torah Shebe'al Peh means oral law, the oral Torah. There's also Torah Shebichtav. Torah Shebichtav is the written Torah. The written Torah are the first five books of the Bible. That's the written Torah. The oral Torah is the Mishnah, is the Torah that was handed down from father to son until it was finally compiled 1,800 years ago. The Jews were forced to put it in writing. They didn't want to, but because it was better when it was transmitted orally. But they were forced to put it in writing when the Romans outlawed Judaism and were going to murder anybody who practiced Judaism, so to prevent losing the great oral Torah, they finally put it in writing. And that was 1,800 years ago. And the oral Torah teaches us that Terach, in his giant shop of giant idols, one day had to travel somewhere. So he told his son Abraham, to watch over the idols. Abraham was filled with zealous devotion to God. He already believed in God, and he knew there was only one God, and he knew the idols represented nonsense, and that this was crazy and was bad for the world. And so Abraham smashed all of his father's idols except for one. He left one big, strong, one of the big, strong stone idols there. And he put in the idol's hand the hammer that he used to smash all the other idols. So he smashed hundreds of idols in his father's store. Every idol in his father's store except for one. And in that one idol that he did not want, that one graven image that he didn't smash, again, he put the hammer. He put the hammer he used in that idol's hand. And when his father came home and said, "What is this? Look at this. Look at the destruction here. Look what happened to all my idols and all my graven images. Look at this. What happened?" His father asked him, and Abraham said to his father, to Terach, his father, "This idol here smashed all of the other idols." And he had the hammer, that idol, he put a hammer in the stone, in the idol's stone hand. And he said, "He smashed all of the other idols." Abraham told his father, Terach. And Terach said to Abraham, "What, are you kidding me? Give me a break. He can't do that, he's just stone. He's not able to go smashing idols. Come on. There's no way he could do that." And so Abraham said to his father, "Oh, he's not able to break other idols up. He can't do that because he's just stone. But you believe that he created the heavens and the earth and that he's a god? And you worship him like he's a god? That you believe that he's a god and created the whole world and the heavens and the earth? But you don't believe that he could even smash other idols with a hammer?" Anyway, his father didn't buy that explanation. His father, you know, obviously Abraham was right, and it was great wisdom, and an example of the incredible wisdom of Abraham. But his father did not like what his son was doing, and actually reported his son to the authorities. And there's a whole story about what the authorities, what Nimrod, and the authorities did to Abraham. They eventually ordered him to either accept idolatry and give up his belief in one God or face being burned alive in an oven. And Abraham defied it and refused to bow before the idols and said, "You can throw me in the oven, I'm not going to do it." And he was thrown in the oven and he miraculously survived. But we have this great, incredible story here, and of truly, I'd say a handful of the greatest people ever to live, Avraham Avinu, who even at a young age stood for principles, was willing to give his life if necessary, fought against idolatry when the whole world believed in idolatry, was all alone in his beliefs, and that didn't stop him from standing for what was true and for what was right. That's the example he set. And we're taught that the example he set would be a symbol for Jews in all generations, Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. What the fathers did is in fact an example for the sons eventually. In other words, we, the Jewish people, will eventually do the same thing. We will also bear witness to the nations. We will be a light unto the nations and a holy nation, a nation of priests. And we will also be willing to walk into the ovens and give our lives if necessary for the sake of truth. That's the destiny of the Jewish people. That's what God chose the Jewish people to be. A nation of truth and a nation of people willing to sacrifice and give everything for the truth, as the Jews have done for thousands of years. And because the Jews were willing to do that for thousands of years, because of that, they are called a light unto the nations and a holy nation and a nation of priests. And they will eventually someday awaken the whole world to the truth. Anyway, thank you very much, Muman. And now we go to the great Dan Ben Noach. All the great ones are on this week, all the great people. Dan Ben Noach, of course, is our great administrator on the forum. And what can I say? It doesn't get better than Dan Ben Noach. He is absolutely the best, the best of the best. Dan Ben Noach writes, and I quote, "Shalom Chaim, are you familiar with the Meir Panim charity? If so, what is your opinion of it?" Unquote. I don't know that much about the charity itself. I haven't really studied the charity, but I know that I remember seeing on their page, I don't know if they still have it, I haven't been to their page recently, but I remember seeing on their website something about a big thing with a Mortimer Zuckerman Nutrition Center. And that turned me off right away. That's a red flag for me right away, because Mortimer Zuckerman is the ultimate example of a self-hating Jew. If he's involved with something, I stay away from it like it's radioactive. Mortimer Zuckerman is the owner of the New York Daily News, which fanatically supported Obama in 2008. I don't know what they're going to do this year, but in 2008, fanatically supported Obama. Mortimer Zuckerman is a billionaire who intermarried. I mean, with all his money, he intermarried. He's in other words, like all the other self-hating Jews who do the terrible things that self-hating wealthy Jews so often do. And Mortimer Zuckerman, after the expulsion of Jews from Gush Katif, and this is something people can look up on Google if they want, they can look up this story because it's an unbelievable story of such evil. Mortimer Zuckerman got all the Jewish billionaires together. He's friends with all the other Jewish billionaires in New York. And he got them all together and he said, let's give tens of millions of dollars to the Hamas Muslim Nazi terrorists in Gaza. Let's give the Hamas Arab Muslim Nazis in Gaza tens of millions of dollars now. So maybe they'll build up the Gaza economy and this will be good for peace. So they gave tens of millions of dollars out of their own pocket. These are all Jewish billionaires and multi-billionaires. Gave tens of millions of dollars to Arab Muslim Nazis that have sworn to exterminate the Jewish people and that have the blood of many Jews on their hands already and have sworn to exterminate the whole Jewish people. And these animals, these assimilated, self-hating, super-rich, arrogant animals whom God has given all this money to, use their money to help these mass murderers. Mortimer Zuckerman organized that little thing, and they gave a huge, I don't remember how much it was, but it was a huge amount of money in the end to the Muslim Nazis in Hamas. And he is now on the page of the Meir Panim charity page, or he was on that page. I don't know if he still is. But he was on that page prominently. And that's certainly, you know, that's a big turnoff for me if he's involved with them in any way. That says to me, hey, wait a minute, there's something here. Who knows what the hell they're doing? Maybe their charity is all, because they say they're helping the poor in Israel. Does that mean they also help the Arab Muslim Nazi poor? Anyone who gives anything to Arab Muslim Nazis is making it easier for them to stay in Israel and is endangering Jewish lives. We should do everything we can to make it as difficult as possible for the Arabs so that they'll leave Israel. So, you know, that was something that turned me off right away. Anyway, thank you so much, Dan, or Dan. I'm calling you already in Hebrew, Dan. Actually, I should call you that in Hebrew because you speak Hebrew. You speak Hebrew fluently, and you translate all of our Hebrew videos, or you provide English subtitles for all of our Hebrew videos. Baruch Hashem, thank God. And now we go to the great Say No to Islam, who writes, and I quote, please give Yimach Shmo to August Kreis. He is the leader of Aryan Nazi nations who supported bin Laden after 9/11 and called for the extermination of the Jews, unquote. Yeah, and you know, it's amazing, Say No to Islam, that he actually held a press conference a few years back, and he said he wants to form an alliance with Al-Qaeda. He actually announced that he and the Aryan nations, they want to form an alliance with Al-Qaeda. And he wasn't arrested and charged. I mean, he was arrested later for other stuff that is unrelated to this, because he also, you know, committed all types of fraud and other things. I mean, that has nothing to do with this. Why wasn't he arrested? He's holding a press conference and declaring that he wants to form an alliance with an organization that's at war with the United States and has murdered thousands of Americans and committed the worst act of terrorism on American soil in American history. He should have been arrested immediately for treason and sedition. He should be executed as a traitor. Nothing happened to him when he did that. Very interesting. Just a little comment. And, you know, the Nazis do support Al-Qaeda and do support the Muslim terrorists. That's what the Nazis and the KKK and all these other groups, they support that. Why? Partly because the Muslim terrorists are against the Jews, and all they care about is killing Jews and their obsession with Jews. That's the only thing they care about. They'll destroy America, they'll destroy the whole world just to get at the Jews. They are the true definition, the ultimate definition of ultimate evil. Ultimate evil. Anyway, thank you, Say No to Islam. And now we go to the great Confederate Kahanist, who writes, and I am Confederate Kahanist, another great, what a great JTFer. all the videos and all the help on YouTube and all the great stuff Confederate Kahanist has done. Confederate Kahanist writes, and I quote, "Tell us about Gary Johnson's immigration policy," unquote. Gary Johnson, the libertarian candidate for president, supports open borders. That's his immigration policy. He says the problem with the United States is we don't have enough third world people flooding in. We should have even more. We should greatly liberalize and facilitate people who want to come into the country. He thinks we should open up our borders much more. And by the way, Ron Paul also favors that. Ron Paul and his son Rand Paul, when they were first running in 1988, when Ron Paul was the libertarian candidate for president, he ran on a platform of open borders, letting anyone who wants to come in here just march into the country and come in the United States and stay in the United States. He said that what is this, that we need papers and you need... Ron Paul was really running... you look at the libertarian platform. What he was saying, within 1 year the United States would be finished. That would be the end of the United States within 1 year if the United States did that. If the United States said, okay, no more border control, nothing, everybody comes in, there are no more papers, you come in, that's it, you're here, and you got the same rights as American citizens. If we did that, within 1 year the United States would be finished. That would be the end of the United States. Within 1 year, there'd be such a flood from all over the world, within 1 year that's the end of America. That was Ron Paul, that's Rand Paul, that's Gary Johnson. Anyway, thank you very much, Confederate Kahanist. And I thank all of our great JTFers for another important program. And this is a critical week coming up. So we gotta keep fighting here. We got a close election, critical week. I don't have to tell you, our great JTFers, just how important this is, how much is at stake. So let's pray to God, and let's get involved now more than ever. Until next week, shalom.